Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com.
Hi, this is T. Michael Coleman, and you're listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who plays bluegrass.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Bluegrass Jam Along. This is the first of two extremely special episodes that I want to share with you to celebrate Dot Watson's 100th birthday, which would have been today, March 3rd, 2023. Back in November, I was doing a bit of reading and realised that this year was going to be Doc's 100th birthday, and I had a little thought that maybe I'd talk to a couple of people and put something together to celebrate it. And so I sent out a couple of emails, had a couple of chats with people, thought, cool, I'll have a nice hour-long episode that celebrates Doc. And then I emailed a couple more people, and people just kept saying yes. And people kept telling me who else I should talk to, and I just kept having conversations, and it's been a joy. But I ended up with hours and hours of material. And what I've done is I've edited them down into two episodes. This is the first, and there is a second also out now. So go and grab that one as well. And this has been such a joy putting these together, I cannot tell you. And I've split them roughly along two lines. The first one, you're going to hear from people who've worked with Doc, played with Doc, and are sort of having a hand in carry on his legacy. So you're going to hear from Happy Tram from Homespun Tapes. You're going to hear from John McEwen all about recording the Will the Circle Be Unbroken record. You're going to hear from T. Michael Coleman and Jack Lawrence, who spent years between them playing with Doc. You're going to hear from Lindsay Craven, who's the Millfest Artist Relations Manager, who is working on booking acts for Millfest. And you're also going to hear from Ted Olson, who's a Professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University. But he also wrote the book that accompanies the Doc box set, A Life's Work, that came out last year. These are all new interviews. The stuff with T. Michael, Jack Lawrence, John McEwen, none of this has been heard before. These are all interviews people agreed to do for these episodes. And one of the joys of doing this is just how much people were happy to talk about Doc and happy to talk to me if they didn't know about Doc and just share their time and their memories. And it's been an extraordinary experience, and I really hope that you get something out of it. So I'm going to start off with the conversation I had with Happy Tram from Homespun Tapes, who sort of talks about working with Doc. And how he first got to hear him.
I think when the first Watson Family album came out on Folkways was the first time I ever heard Doc. And my friends and I were listening to it, and we were just blown away. We had never heard anybody, especially play fills on the guitar the way he did. It was a completely new experience. Most guitarists we knew maybe were pretty good finger pickers like Merle Travis or Libba Cotton or people like that. But those lightning fast, absolutely clean, clear fill-ins that he played while in the middle of a song just knocked us out. We just didn't know what was going on. And then he came to New York. I think he and Clarence Ashley did a concert for Friends of Old Time Music in New York, which was an organization that, as the name implies, they brought a lot of old-time blues and country musicians to the city. And so we got to see Doc in person there and also at Gertie's Folk City, the premier New York City folk club, which was the main place we used to go in the early 60s to hear all these legendary people, and to hear Doc and Clarence Ashley and also many other people in those days, we barely ever saw photographs of these people, much less see them in person. It was like some mythology coming to life. It was quite amazing somebody like Mississippi John Hurt to suddenly see him in the flesh, playing at a little cafe in Greenwich Village. It was just, or any of those people, Lightning Hopkins, or, it just made everything just three-dimensional. It was like, it, you know, these people that you only heard on record and barely knew what they looked like. So the same was true of Doc. You know, and of course we thought he was a backwoods Appalachian guy, you know, unschooled, whatever you think about, you know, when you're a city person listening to those old records. And, you know, he was this very sophisticated, interesting, intelligent person, you know, who it's true he had not been to the city much at that point. And he was brought to the city by Ralph Rinsler, as I remember the first time I heard him. Ralph was acting as his manager and as his kind of go-between. Ralph was a wonderful guy, and he was very, very good for Doc and Bill Monroe, both bringing them to young audiences in urban areas. So that was my introduction to Doc, but I didn't really get to know him very much until a little bit later, a few years later. My brother Artie and I used to tour around colleges and some folk festivals around the Northeast. And we'd run into Doc and Merle quite often on the sort of on the trail, so to speak. And kind of became friendly with them. We, you know, we'd sit backstage and have conversations. And Merle especially was an interesting guy and was very, basically very shy and a little withdrawn at first. But once you got to know him, he became a kind of a different person. So we became friendly with Merle, I would say more in backstages and, you know, in the parking lots of festivals. And then I had this idea. We had been doing Homespun at that point for a few years, maybe 9 or 10 years by that time. And I already started reaching out to more traditional players than people who were just in my New York circle or Woodstock at that point. So I broached the idea to Merle about doing a lesson on his guitar styles. And Merle, who, as I say, was a very reticent person when it came to speaking, especially in public. He rarely spoke on stage, as you probably know. It took a little convincing to actually get a microphone up and talk about this stuff. But he eventually said he would do it. And so I made a trip down to North Carolina, visited Doc and Rosalie and Merle, and spent 2 or 3 or 4 days hanging out at their house, and made some initial recordings of Merle, and Doc sat in on guitar and backed him up, but definitely did not want his name associated. He really only wanted Merle associated with this. He didn't want it to be a Doc Watson project. He wanted it to be a Merle Watson. And actually, I'm going to backtrack a minute. I think the first sessions I did with Merle, he came to Woodstock. I think he came to Woodstock on his own. And I remember him, he came and stayed with us. And the first session that I did, I just, like I did with all the other early Homespun audio tapes, just set up a mic and with my little reel-to-reel recorder, wall and sack or whatever it was in the house, very low tech, and sat and asked Merle the questions and asked him what he used for a slide and how he played these different songs. And Merle was very taken by Mississippi John Hurt. That was his, more than even his dad, that was his main influence. He loved John Hurt's fingerpicking, and he loved that whole style of music. So, you know, we'd go out to eat or, you know, at the local Woodstock joints. He just loved that atmosphere, and I introduced him to some of the local players. I think he met Paul Butterfield and Rick Danko in Woodstock, and he seemed to be having a great time. And I think we did the initial sessions there. And in fact, I have some pictures of him at a barbecue in our backyard. And actually, one of the visitors who also was there at the same time was Robin Williamson from the Incredible String Band. And so they got to meet each other in our backyard. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a funny little meeting. And Merle very much came out of his shell. You know, he's very, as I said, he's very shy and reticent at first, but he became much more sociable and as the time went on. And then I did go down to North Carolina after that, and then Doc backed him up on a bunch of things, and Rosalie made dinner and breakfast biscuits. First time I ever had biscuits and gravy and all that Southern stuff, you know, sausages. And so, you know, we got to know them fairly well that way. And of course, when Merle was in Woodstock, he loved Jane, my wife, who was also my partner in Homespun, but he and Jane got along really great too. So when we put out this, now these were on cassettes, the first series that we put out on the guitar styles of Merle Watson. And Doc and Merle were absolutely thrilled. Doc and Rosalie were totally thrilled that Merle had something under his own name at that point. He was always so in Doc's shadow and a little reluctant, I think, to be on the road with Doc and to be doing so much traveling and so much responsibility to look after Doc, that the fact that he did something on his own was a big source of pride for Doc and Rosalie. And they always mentioned it whenever I saw him. The few times that I went to visit them in Deep Gap, they just welcomed us with open arms because that meant so much to them. And of course, after Merle's very untimely and sudden passing, they were even more loving in their appreciation of what we had done. And in fact, at Merlefest for many years, in a glass case with other memorabilia of Merle's on display, was his Homespun cassette series. So it was a very meaningful thing for all of us to have worked with him in that way.
And then did that sort of lead on directly to doing some work with Doc as well for Homespun?
Yes, I think once we got that out of the way and Doc knew that we weren't exploiting him, we set this up ahead of time, of course, with Ralph Rinsler and some of the people at Merlefest, and we got our own Homespun workshop stage at Merlefest. And this would have been around 92, maybe something like that, 91 or 92. And we set up a whole series of workshops, brought a film crew with us. We taped a couple of days of workshop sessions, and Doc agreed to do one. That was our first, it's called, Doc's Guitar. And again, that was, I think, the first time Doc ever actually explained on camera what he was doing. So I think that was a very meaningful and historic thing for us to work with him beforehand, tell him what kind of things we wanted him to explain. And he did both finger picking and flat picking. So he would play and then explain, Deep River Blues or Black Mountain Rag and all these, you know, showstoppers that he would do at almost every performance. So he was Doc actually talking about it and slowing it down and giving people an opportunity to figure out how to do it more or less on their own. And Mike Seeger was there. We had some great people in the room there, you know, who were also doing workshops. So, you know, that was also really a great couple of days. And Doc was very pleased with it. He was pleased with the way it came out. And a few years later, we asked him to do another one just on his flat picking. And we went back to Wilkesboro, where Merlefest takes place, and set up a film crew again. This time it was just Doc, and he had asked for Steve Kaufman, who had done a lot of work for us as a, you know, he's a fabulous flat pick guitarist and was in awe, like all of us, of Doc. But Doc specifically asked for him to be his kind of interlocutor, if you will, his the guy who asked him the questions and led him to create something that was meaningful and good for other pickers. So again, we went and visited them in Deep Gap and spent a couple of days there, and then went into this nice studio at the college in Wilkesboro, Wilkes Community College, it's called, and spent a day shooting that video with Doc. So we're immensely proud of having done that, been really the only ones, I think, that had done that kind of work with him. And we stayed friends and, you know, stayed close, connecting. Whenever we saw them, when he would come to New York, we'd go to the show and always sit backstage and, you know, hang out with him. Doc was a fabulously interesting guy. Was very knowledgeable about many, many things beyond just the guitar and traditional folk and mountain music. I came to appreciate over the years how wide-ranging his knowledge of a lot of things was. I'm sure there are other people that could speak to this as well. One time when we visited him in Deep Gap, he was on the roof of his house fixing the shingles on his roof. And, you know, for somebody, I have perfect sight, perfect vision, and I've never been on the roof fixing the shingles. So it's not something I would necessarily do. And I know he wired his house for light. If he hadn't been blind from a very early age, who knows what he might have done. Probably not music. He probably would have done science or engineering or any number of other things. He was just a remarkable guy. And mainly after that, I would see him at Merlefest every year backstage, and we'd hang out and just chat, and always super nice, always asked about the family, about my brother, who sadly passed away in 2008, but Doc always expressed, you know, remorse about that too. So we had a nice relationship. I can't say I knew him as well as people like Michael Coleman or Jack Lawrence or the other people that spent many, many days and weeks and years on the road with Doc, but I always felt a closeness to him. And Jane, my wife, did also, very dear, and also Rosalie, who always greeted us with great love and affection when we saw her.
I think that's a lovely conversation to have kicked this whole thing off with. The next person I spoke to, these aren't in any kind of order, these are just me trying to group things together in some form that makes sense. And I spoke to John McEwen. Now, John is a founding member of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and he was instrumental in putting together the Will the Circle Be Unbroken record, which played a huge part in Doc coming to the attention of the world. And I just feel so blessed to have had the chance to talk to John about this. He was very generous with his time, and just, you know, a fascinating chat about such a influential record. So here's John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
I didn't know it, but are you familiar with his album Uncle Charlie and His Dog Teddy?
Yeah.
Well, that had two bluegrass tunes on it. Les wanted to do Clinch Mountain Backstep. I did too. But I wanted to do Randy Lynn Rag. And I didn't know at the time that Doc Watson was from the Clinch Mountain area. But he heard this album. Merle Watson played it for him, his son. And I didn't know Earl Scruggs would ever hear this. I hoped. Randy Lynn Rag was named after his son, Randy Lynn. And Gary Scruggs told me he heard Bojangles and I had to get it. He had to go buy a copy. And he went to the store. They were sold out. So he bought the album. He listened to the record, Bojangles. Oh, good. That's the one. He took it home. His dad listened to, that's nice. That Bojangles song is nice. And then he played some of Shelley's Blues. Then he played Randy Lynn Rag. And, well, Earl said, let's go meet that boy that played Randy Lynn Rag the way I intend to. And a month later, they came to our first Nashville show. That led to the friendship that 6 months later, I asked Earl Scruggs in Colorado, taking him back to a hotel after every night for 5 nights. Earl, would you maybe record with the Nitty Gritty? And he goes, I'd be proud to. Now the next week, Doc Watson, oh, I called my brother and said, Earl said yes. And then Doc Watson was there the next week, and I asked him, I was a little braver, although I'd never met Doc, Mr. Watson, would you like to make a record with us and Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and Earl Scruggs? It was kind of, if Earl's going to be there, I want to pick. And I had admired Doc ever since that Newport folk music album. You know, he was playing Doc's guitar, yeah. Burning up Doc's guitar. He's in the middle of it, he says, the sun's hot, ain't it? Or something like that. And Deep River Blues and stuff. And I'd admired Earl for forever. And on Monday, my brother said, I'm going to get Merle Travis. And he called Merle Travis. And anyway, that's how we got Doc. And then the album, 3 weeks into that process, is when we told the other guys in the Dirt Band, we're going to go to Nashville and make a bluegrass album. I didn't want to. Bill and I, my brother and I, decided not to tell the guys right off because Jeff had a nickname, Dr. No. And I said, we don't want Dr. No getting upset. So when we could come to Jeff and say, Jeff, we're going to record with Earl Scruggs, Doc Watson, Merle Travis. And by then, Bill and I got Earl to ask Maybelle Carter. And she said, yes. I was a huge Maybelle fan. And well, she lived in the Clinch Mountains, too. So Clinch Mountain backstep was a good thing to record. How did that happen? I don't know. But then we asked him. Oh, we had Jimmy Martin, too. And one of the guys goes, who's Jimmy Martin? Well, you'll find out. Yeah, Jimmy Martin, the man that thought everyone has a right to his opinion. Hi, I'm Jimmy Martin, world's best bluegrass singer. Well, nice to meet you, Mr. Martin. Yeah, that was how he'd introduce himself.
Brilliant. So it sounds like it all came together pretty quickly then.
8 weeks after I asked Earl that question, and during the next week, Doc Watson, 8 weeks after that, we started recording. And 5 days later, we were done.
Wow.
And it was 6 days. It actually, we did 36 cuts in 6 days. And the book that I put out, 50 years making the landmark album, 50 years anniversary, it describes the whole thing. My brother took the photographs. He was a manager and the producer of the band and photographer. He took early Dirt Band shots and all the session shots. Well, I took one. And anyway, there's a story with each photograph. And I've been so happy because people have emailed me and I've seen it posted. I feel like I'm at the sessions. I feel like I'm there. This really, you know, because you can read the book and see the picture, and now you can hear what is going on there, and you kind of, if you're playing the record, you are there. You can close your eyes. No, you got to read. But it's really a neat thing.
And that's one of the really cool things about the record itself is hearing the record being made as you listen to the record. There's all the studio chat and you hear the little like beautiful moments like Doc meeting Merle Travis, you know, and having a chat. It's all just captured because the mics are still on and people are still taping stuff. And it feels like a record and a documentary at the same time.
Well, my brother was, he got in the music business so he could get in the film business. Because he couldn't just walk into the film business. He'd been to film school for a couple years. And music was close. And I was in a band. Bill, would you manage my band? Oh, okay. And so he became the manager. And he later produced 5 or 6 Steve Martin movies. He managed Steve Martin, the comedian, also. Steve and I went to high school together and worked in Disneyland as teenagers in the magic shop or selling magic tricks. It was really fun. And fast forward 50 years, I produced Steve's album, The Crow.
It's a great album.
Oh, I'm glad you like it. Yeah, I produced that and we won a Grammy. Oh boy. I'm glad you have it.
Yeah, did you have any sense when you were recording the record that it was going to become, like, was it just, oh, we're going in the studio, we're making another record with our heroes because that's what we want to do? Or did you have a sense that it was going to be what it became?
The Circle album was important to me when we got the lineup, when I found out who Vassar Clements was, because I didn't know. They didn't have album credits. I asked Earl if he found fiddlers that could handle all the different styles. He goes, I found one man. I said, what's his name? Vassar Clements. Well, can he handle it all, Earl? And he just said, he'll do. Actually, he said it more like, he'll do. It was more, it was like so confident that you just, yes, sir. And Earl got the bass player. He was playing at the Grand Ole Opry. He played on everybody's records a lot, and Junior was perfect. And with all those people coming through the studio, by day 3, it was like, this is really more music, more songs. It went from being a double album to being a triple album. My brother's idea was to have a tape recorder running all the time. At 3¾ inches per second, you know, slower. The master tape was running at 30 inches per second. And the talking tape was running 3¾ inches per second. And that's what pop, well, that's what I had to change the reels on that. But that was okay. It was a very special thing. We wanted to get Doc Watson and Merle Travis meeting for the first time, you know. So we set it up to have Merle come by when Doc was recording on day 3. And Merle came by and starts talking. I had to interrupt. Excuse me, I got to get my brother saying, move the mic, in the control room, you know. And I put the mic in front of Merle and let them talk.
And what are your memories of Doc at those sessions?
When we were recording Tennessee Stud, that was one that my brother really wanted to get with Doc because he just has a perfect voice. And I'm sitting with my headphones on, plunking on the banjo, along about 1825. And about the end of the first verse, I went, I'm playing on an old record. This is 1938. This is 1935. This guy is real. Doc Watson was real. He was really what so many people have emulated. And even me, I play Doc's guitar, a finger pick, and but he really played it. But his Tennessee Stud, that really captured a moment. that was done one take, and he did it perfect. I think everybody else performed right too, but it sounds so captivating. I'm sitting there with the headphones on, listening. I'm playing on this record. I better pay attention. You know, it was really wonderful. Way Downtown, Fraylin the banjo, you know. And that was easy as pie because Doc was driving it. He had a rhythm. He had a spirit. He was like Levon Helm was with the drums. Levon Helm of the band?
Yeah.
And when Levon was playing in the group, sitting in with somebody or whatever, everybody was happy because he had a way of playing. He called me to play the 70th birthday party in Woodstock, and I took my wife, and she wasn't a band fan. She never didn't really pay attention. And the only place to stand after I did my set and watch him was like 3 feet away from his drums, you know, like really close. By the third song, I said, "Honey, we can move to the back of the room, I think." She goes, "No, this is fine. This guy's great." You know, because he was quiet and he was like singing so good. And that's what Doc was like. Doc was just really his spirit of what he was doing came through his notes, his precise chuck chuck chuck, and man, and his voice, it was one of the best feelings in the world. I sat in with Doc a couple dozen times over the years, and pick that banjo, John. You know, it was like when I take my solo to see him go, ha ha, you know, at the end. Yeah, that's it. You know, the approval that would give you, the feeling that I want to be in this club. Oh, I'm in it. I joined for a brief moment. I rarely got that feeling with the group I was in, but I did sometimes. It was a different thing. But playing with Doc was wonderful.
So that was John McEwen from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band talking about Will the Circle Being Broken. I'm going to move on to a couple of people who spent a long time playing with Doc, and anybody who knows a bit about Doc will be familiar with these names. And first up, we've got T. Michael Coleman, who played bass with Doc and toured with Doc for, you know, 15 years. And just, I mean, what a fascinating insight into Doc, and what an interesting conversation to have. Here's T. Michael.
When I was in college, I was on a work study program to help pay for my college. And there was a coffee house in the student union. So I would sometimes, you know, go help out with the sound. And one of those times being when Doc and Merle were playing at the coffee house, which was 10 miles from Deep Gap. And the next time they came around, I was not scheduled to work the sound. But on that day, someone came and knocked on my dorm door and said, Merle said he wanted that hippie guy to come over and run the sound for them again. So, and what's interesting is years later, after I had played with Doc and Merle for a while, he hadn't connected those two things. And I reminded him that was me. But the way I started playing with them is I was in another band in college and after college. And we sometimes opened up for Doc and Merle, and we were very progressive. We were playing Shady Grove with conga drums and electric guitars. You know, it was sort of like a Mumford and Sons, but back in the 70s, early 70s. Merle would hang out with us a bit because we were close in age. And when that band disbanded, pretty much within a couple of weeks, I was in the hardware store in Boone, North Carolina. And Merle followed me in, and he said, would you like to come play with me and Daddy? And, of course, living in Boone near Deep Gap, they were idolized, and my answer was quicker than his sentence ended. So they wanted me to come down to the house and play a couple of songs and see if it would be a nice fit. So I went and made the mistake. Any Southern boy should know better than try to knock on the front door, because no one in the South uses their front door because they gather things in front of the door. So Rosalie, after a bit of clattering, she opened the door and said, "Honey, come around the back." So I went around the back and went in, and there sat Doc Watson, and I was pretty speechless at the time. They had set up an amplifier for me. I had my bass. They decided that we would play T for Texas. We played T for Texas, and Doc said, "He'll do." And that's the last time we practiced for 15 years.
Wow. That's amazing. And it's a really interesting, like, for a figure that is so connected with sort of traditional and roots music, the idea of having a trio with an electric bass was pretty progressive in itself at that point.
I think it was a banner of being progressive and convenient, because they knew traveling with a stand-up bass would be, you know, bothersome. Although we weren't flying, we were traveling in a Winnebago at the time. And Merle always had his eye and his ear on what was happening. And bluegrass festivals were merging with rock and roll festivals.
Mm.
And the sound systems at that particular time weren't the best in the world. And also with me playing electric bass, they put pickups in their guitars. They weren't relying on microphones or the sound man that was sitting out front that had been there for too many days and had too many other things influencing him. And it was basically they wanted to be heard, and Merle liked my interaction with the way they played, and those were the factors. And I don't know that being progressive was the top thing. It was many things in that recipe.
And do you remember sort of what the first shows you played with them were?
First show I did with him was at the Exit Inn in Nashville, Tennessee. And in the audience was Waylon Jennings and a bunch of other country music stars. And there I was, a green kid from North Carolina. And I was pretty much awestruck. And I sat in the middle as a result of not ever rehearsing, and Doc knew so many songs that I would look back and forth to the guitar necks so I could follow along. And it made it a little difficult sometimes when they were capoed in two different positions. But that's why I sat there.
And that was it from that day on, you sat in the middle?
I sat in the middle, yes. Which is unusual because, you know, the star of the show usually sits in the middle. And there were some TV shows where they would rearrange where we were sitting. And, you know, Doc being blind, sometimes he would forget that. And he would always lean over to his right to talk to me, yet I wasn't there. And I would talk from the other side. And it sort of, wait a minute, you're in the wrong place.
Yeah, I guess, you know, just the things that you get used to. On some things you take for granted on stage when you can see everybody around you. And I think it's really interesting, the sight line to be able to see their guitars, because anybody who's played in any kind of bluegrass jam knows that being able to see the guitar player's hands is really useful.
Oh, it's very useful, because it's impossible to know every song. And Doc and Merle, they were really good about telegraphing where it was going. The only really difficult thing that served me well in my music career was Doc being a very, you know, a mountain player first, and sometimes a lover of Delta blues, he would just sometimes skip a beat. Okay, let's go to the four chord. Yet you hadn't counted the four yet. Maybe it was three and a half, but somehow he would telegraph that move, which I was able to follow in later years.
And being from a similar sort of area to them, did you sort of, I guess that the repertoire of material that they played was huge, but I guess if you grew up in that area and knew a lot of that music anyway, it probably gave you a fair head start.
No.
Excellent.
I was a rock and roll guy.
Okay.
I was I was a Beatles fan from the day I heard them. And rock and roll, Led Zeppelin, that's what I listened to. I did grow up with an Uncle Woodrow that played banjo, and that, you know, that was in the back of my head. And all that kind of music at family reunions was considered, you know, homemade, made-up music. And I was in a rock and roll band. And I was in a rock and roll band until I went to college and discovered folk music while I was in college, and discovered who Doc was in a music store. There was a display of albums, and I asked the proprietor, "Who is that?" And there I was, 10 miles from where Doc lives. He says, "That's Doc Watson. You've never heard of Doc Watson?" I said, "Did he play with Hendrix?" I don't know who he is. So he gave me an album, and I went home and listened to it, and I was shocked and amazed. And what struck me most was that I understood what they were doing rhythmically, that I could fit into that slot and not cover them up or cloud up their music. I knew I could do that, and you know, it came to fruition later.
And that's some learning curve in terms of the repertoire then, if you came at it from a different world.
No, because rock and roll is a good prerequisite to anything because it involves a lot of chords, a lot of rhythms. So the lucky thing for me is when I was in a band in high school, I was the guy who would buy the records and learn the songs. And that gave me an education of how music works theoretically. And that served me well into playing with Doc and Merle because I understood what goes together.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you've got a good ear, then that's half the battle. And was there anything sort of when you found yourself playing with them on stage up close, was there anything about the playing that sort of surprised you or you hadn't picked up from the records? Is there anything different about being sat in between them?
The power of three people playing in sync. It was, you know, I have listened to recordings, you know, within the last few years, and it was like a freight train. It was rhythmically, it was like no other band I've ever played with. It's just everyone did what they needed to do and stayed out of each other's way. But the power of that trio, I pitied any band that followed us.
It's an amazing thing when people can make acoustic music that feels, you know, like a complete rhythm section and everything's there. And just that, the power of you can generate just with picks and strings and hands when you hear the best people do it is astonishing.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the syncopation and everything mixing together. It's not a full-blown band playing at 100%. It's playing in your lane, complementing the other players, and therefore you're creating a better auditory picture that comes at you stronger because nothing is psychoacoustically eliminating the other.
Yeah, totally. That makes a huge amount of sense. And you played with Doc like for the next 10, 15 years. It was that. Did
years.
You imagine when you first arrived, did you imagine it would go on anywhere near as long as that?
That didn't cross my mind. I was in such a humbled space and that I was sitting there playing with these guys and, you know, from place to place, realizing the respect people had for them. You know, there'd be people coming to the concerts and they would be in such awe of Doc. They would be nervous just to meet him.
We'll be right back with you just after this. We'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long-time supporter of the Bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small. And now, by sponsoring Bluegrass Jam Along. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. With 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass, and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation has something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory, and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month, and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com. Yeah, it's amazing. Just now, obviously, you know, I've never seen Doc live, never met Doc. And from, you know, a whole ocean away in a different continent, just the power of that music to spellbind people, and the way just carrying out the interviews for this podcast and talking to people about Doc, and the sort of the depth of feeling people have about the music, and that comes from the person.
It is. That's exactly right. It comes from the person. There was no pretense. He was who he was. He was Arthur Watson from the mountains of North Carolina. And his blindness almost gave him an advantage over everyone, because no matter where he played, he was in his, he could feel as though he were playing for his relatives or for friends. And he would really get involved in the songs, especially the really emotional songs. I can't, you know, tell you how many times he would break down in tears because a lyric would hit him so hard and so meaningfully. And Doc, and his personality came across. And I think people were shocked when they met him. That guy you saw on the stage is the same guy sitting in the dressing room.
Yeah, and we've sort of, I think, as pop music has grown as an industry over the past few decades, we've reached a point where people are trying to project so much. Like, you can hear people trying to be emotional when they sing on a huge amount of pop records. And so when you hear a record from somebody who is just being themselves and just singing, whether that's Doc Watson or Hank Williams or whoever,
right,
it's just like, it's like somebody's opened the curtains and let the sun in. It's just so direct and so, like, unaffected. It's right. A beautiful thing.
It's basically the ability to open a vein and bleed. It's what you're doing. When he would sing song, especially when members of his family would die and when Merle died, there's certain just lines in the song, almost, you know, it would bring about tears, and he was visualizing in his head, you know, his loved one. And that, you know, songs that were written back in the mountains were written to express feelings, to communicate. And he kept doing that throughout his career. He was communicating more than entertaining.
Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it. Because anybody, any form of art is essentially an attempt to communicate with people.
Yes.
It's taking a bit of what it's like to be you as a human and trying to connect that with other people and express it in some form.
Without trying.
Yeah. Well, and some people do try, and it's the trying can put you off. But it's, and I was really curious because you obviously played with Doc again in the last couple of years. And was anything particularly different at that point? Was it still pretty much the same sort of feeling, or did he sort of changed as a musician in any way?
Well, he was still Doc, and he was still playing well, but he was, you could tell he was getting older, and that part changed. But the reason he was still out there at that age is because he loved playing in front of an audience.
And I think you see that just watching things that were recorded fairly late on, like the Three Pickers concert, for example, there's just such a power there still, and such a, and you to see the joy other people get from the music was one of the first things, you know, I got into Doc Watson relatively late in my life, but to see the effect the music had on other people is almost as appealing as the effect of the music itself. It's part of the, it's just, it's something that, you can't not notice.
Absolutely. He, he, through his expression of music and his background, he, when he first went to New York during what, Doc and I would laugh about and call the folk scare of the 60s. When you were talking about trying too hard, you would have people on stage singing in four-part unison, is what we used to say. And so when Doc and Bill Monroe and those guys started going up to New York, all these people would gather and they go, now that, there's the real thing. That's what we're trying to hear. You know, Maria Muldaur, Bob Dylan, Jose Feliciano, whoever was in New York, they would always flock to see Doc or Bill Monroe or any of the real guys.
And it's fascinating that, that whole period, you know, the, just how much, overly produced, overly sort of, I think Brian Sutton described it as homogenized, but just the folk music with all the edges taken off it that was sort of put out for the pop audience.
Yeah, lounge folk.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. Well, and it's when you...
That's when the A&R people and the music people, we need to, you know, round out the corners to appeal to more people. But they're taking away the things that I think would bring in more people. It's amazing how Doc would pull in rock and roll people and folk people. It's because they identified with, it wasn't so much the genre of music, it was the stories behind the music and how he got there and his folksiness from the stage without even trying.
And sometimes when you take the edges off something to try and sell it to a bigger crowd, you actually remove what the thing is completely. It's the edges that make it what it is sometimes.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, young people will always come back to the edges. But, you know, that's what happens. Look at how many people have flocked to Billy Strings, how many people have flocked to bluegrass music and, you know, the Mumford and Sons. They took advantage of that, but not on purpose, I don't think. But, you know, and the Avett brothers, they have sort of captured a whole audience that wants genuine music.
Yeah, and it seems to be something that will keep on coming around. Every few years, there's a something else that puts it back in the spotlight. And, you know, people just want those sounds in their ears and they want something that feels like it's from the heart.
You know, there are about three directional signposts that did that. Will the Circle Be Unbroken album by the Dirt Band that brought in a lot. And that's about the time that I started playing with Doc and Merle. Merle had realized these guys appeal to younger people. We need that audience. We need to get up there and we need to have that long-haired guy sitting on stage with us. So that, you know, number one, he can identify with him. And plus he knows how to play. Then the second would be probably, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That movie and Alison Krauss and that music and everyone mistaking that George Clooney sang that song when it was Dan Tominski. And then now it's Billy and the Avett brothers. They're the ones that are packing the stadiums and he always makes a point to say, this is where I got it from. This man is where I got it from.
Yeah. I love that. He doesn't just play the songs because he loves them. He plays the songs and tells you where they came from. So you can go and find them too. It's, you know, and it's, there's something very cool about the fact that, you know, Billy has invited you guys to do the Doc 100 shows with him. And it's sort of brings that whole thing full circle, and it there's something about just keeping that music alive by playing it and loving it and putting it in front of people. So there's something lovely about the fact that he's invited you to do that show as part of his tour.
Yeah, well, Billy and I have been in touch, you know, for a couple of years through the pandemic. I did his podcast with him, and he told me a story. He had never seen Doc before. And he and his mother and his father drove 15, 16 hours to come see us play when we were playing with David Holt near the end. And Billy said he and his family were sitting there in tears the entire time because they had never seen Doc before. And a funny aside, David Holt and I went into a hamburger place to get a hamburger before the show. And Billy said he and his family were sitting there and they were, he was too nervous to come up and say hello to me.
Wow. I mean, yeah, and he, no way would he imagined at that point that at this time he'd be about to share a stage with you all, sort of celebrating Doc's 100th birthday.
It's going to be very special. I think I'm touched by his loyalty, and I think he's going to be touched when we get up there and play with him the first time.
Yeah, and that night you've got Brian Sutton and Molly Tuttle, but there's a whole series of shows you guys are doing as well. It's not just the one show with Billy. You've got a whole set of dates for that as well. And it sounds, I talked to Jack Hinchelwood recently about the shows and just the storytelling and celebration element of it, as much as the music sounds like it's going to be special.
It is. And the trouble is there are stories you can tell and those you can't. And you don't want to be repetitive and tell the same story every time. You know, you want something to be new. So as with the Doc shows, I know Jack Lawrence and I, we're pretty much, off the cuff. What memory springs up that we want to share about Doc?
And you get some memories shared from the audience as well, by the sound of it.
Yes, we do. I think that comes when Ted Olson does his little masterclass at the beginning. I think a lot of people share that. And I have this group called Picket Sun, which is, during the pandemic, my son said, well, why don't you start, a little group and to further the memory of Doc and Merle. And on that, there are a lot of people that share their experiences with Doc and when they've met him. It's quite humbling to, be here in my life and being considered Doc's bass player, his musician. It's something I'm very proud of.
Yeah, and it's something that I think means a lot to a lot of people, and to be able to share those memories with you must be incredibly special to a lot of people.
I think it is. And I love that there have been a lot of families that have named their little girl Sadie after my song.
And you have a recent record out as well, don't you, called Sitting in the Middle, which is also a sort of musical tribute.
It is. It started as a result of this Picket Sun group, and I was home. I was not going anywhere during the pandemic because it was very scary. And I just sat down and started recording songs that I had played with Doc. And I thought, well, I'll just put this on a CD. And of course, my son says, no one buys CDs anymore. What are you doing? So I did it anyway. And it was a labor of love, to say the least. It made me realize how great his song selection was.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because people talk about the guitar playing and people talk about the singing and people talk about banjo playing and people talk about all sorts, but the choice of material, I'm doing a similar episode to celebrate 40 years of Tony Rice's Church Street Blues record. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of interviewing a lot of people for that as well. And it's another one where just song selection is a big part of it. And that, Doc did all those, the old ballads and the fiddle tunes, but he also did some pop songs and he also did things like Tennessee Stud. And he also did some bits of swing and like whatever grabbed his ear was fair game.
And the Dockabilly record, which, boy, that was like pulling teeth to get him to do that. Well, not really. He loved that music and he would always play those songs because he played them when he was supporting his family in a little rockabilly band. It was just hard to get him to let me call it Dockabilly. He did not want that at all. But finally, he acquiesced and let me call it that, which is a perfect name.
I mean, it's too good to let go, right?
Exactly. You got Dwayne Eddy playing on the record. You got Marty Stewart, Junior Brown. It was a lot. We did that in 2 days.
Wow.
Pretty much all the records we ever recorded were done in 1 or 2 days. But not a lot of overdubbing. We would just count to four and play.
So no rehearsals for the gigs, no rehearsals for recording. Turn up, count in, off you go.
No, it's, you know, it's about listening. You know, and I always, when I was, the records that I produced, I always hired the people who knew Doc, and he would invite them on stage to play, like Jerry Douglas and Sam Bush and Stuart Duncan, you know, and Alan O'Brien. They knew Doc, so they knew what to do, and they knew to listen. And that you know, that's 90% of playing music is to listen. And the other half, as Yogi Berra would say.
And I think that sort of loops us back round to where we started this bit, and just the idea that Doc and Merle turned up and you weren't there sound engineering that day, and they, you go and get that guy. He knows what he's doing. He was, you know, he knows how to listen, I guess. And
I guess that was the catalyst of it, that that even though it was probably embedded in the back of Merle's brain that, you know, this guy knows what to listen for, even though he didn't make the connection between musician and old hippie in the back, or young That's hippie so in the back.
That's great. That's all really, really cool stuff. Are there any particular sort of, you know, I mean, out of all those years, it'd be tricky, but are there any particular memories or any particular thoughts you've got that you'd like to share? Any aspects of Doc that you'd, you know, you'd like people to think more about?
He was really uncomfortable with people idolizing him. He didn't know how to respond, you know, for instance, and he treated no one differently. He thought he himself was no better than anyone else, and no one else was better than he. I remember at the Bottom Line in New York one time, John Denver came to the door, and it knocked on the dressing room, and I came out and he says, "Michael, can I meet Doc?" And I said, "I'll go check." So I'll go inside and say, "Doc, John Denver's out here and he wants to say hello." And he says, "Well, tell him just to wait. I'm going to finish my hamburger." Or, you know, we'd be playing somewhere at a concert in Los Angeles, and you look on the side of the stage and there would be Maria Muldaur and Linda Ronstadt and Bonnie Raitt, just, you know, coming to pay homage to Doc. Yet not brave enough to come say hello.
It's funny, isn't it? One of the interviews that I did for this, and I think it was probably with Jack Hinchelwood, saying that Doc's manager had phoned him to tell him he won a Grammy for the first time. And he sort of said, "Yeah, can you call back later? I'm in the middle of watching Love Boat."
That's true. he was nominated, and they wanted to give him a Kennedy Center honor. And he said, "I don't need that. I don't want to do that." You remember the movie Cold Mountain?
Yeah.
The director called me. He wanted to open the movie with Doc Watson sitting in the cabin playing banjo, and he was going to push out into the mountains of North Carolina. And Doc says, "Nah, I don't want to do that." He just didn't need it. He would rather sit home and, eat Rosalie's cooking.
And if you're that grounded in what matters to you and what doesn't, and you put that into your music, it's sort of no wonder that people respond to it.
You know, he always said his music was what he did for a living. It was not who he was. Because when he was home, he was still Doc, but he wasn't that musician Doc. You know, because you have to have a certain mindset to be able to go out there and play, not being affected though, but you know, he was more Arthel than he was Doc Watson at home, because Rosalie's there going, "Arthel, go do this, Arthel, go do that."
And maybe that is a useful thing to be able to have a slightly public version of your persona, that, you know, when he's on stage, he's Doc, and when he's at home, he isn't. Must be a help.
No, I'm sure it helped keep him grounded, and he was a pretty grounded individual. And there was nothing he would not try or do. For instance, in the Winnebago one time, one of the guys, they were driving and they ran into a walkway of a hotel and knocked a huge hole in the Winnebago. So Doc said, "Michael, I think I can fix that. Why don't you pull the Winnebago up here to the second floor landing? I'll climb over the railing on top of the Winnebago." He did that. He patched it with duct tape. and then climbed back over. And that patch was on there the day we sold it 5 years later.
What a great chat. I worked really hard at cutting that one down, and the idea was I was going to include some of that and then release the full thing as a separate episode, but I just couldn't bring myself to remove a single bit of it. It was a fascinating chat, and thanks so much to T. Michael for taking the time to do that. And so through T. Michael, I got in touch with my next guest on this episode, Jack Lawrence, a guitarist who played and toured with Doc for 20 years. And again, just generous, warm, insightful conversation. And again, I didn't take a bit of this out. I left all of this in here. And these are going to be long episodes. And I sort of originally thought I might need to apologize for that. But I just think this is lovely stuff. If you're interested in Doc and his world and his influence and the effect he had on people, I think these are great conversations. So here is Jack Lawrence.
Back in the late 70s, mid-70s, I met Merle Watson through my friend Joe Smothers, who I was playing, we had a rock and roll band, and we also did a folk music duo. And Joe and I did some opening acts for Doc and Merle, and Merle and I became friends in the fall of 1983. I got a phone call from Merle on a Friday afternoon, and he asked me, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, I'm going to mow my grass tomorrow. It's Saturday, and I don't have anything else going on. And he said, well, why don't you go to Lake Charles, Illinois, and play a show with Dad? He just didn't really want to go, I don't think, for whatever reason. And so I did. Merle kept calling me to fill in for him. And it's funny, the first show I figured, okay, we'll do a little bit of rehearsal. That never happened. I mean, I played with Doc for 27 years, and I can count on two fingers how many times we rehearsed. But anyway, it must have worked because, I ended up being there for 27 years. And the first year I played with Doc, I played about 50% of the shows through 1984. In 1985, I played probably 95% or even better because Merle was in the process of building Doc's house. And so he was clearing the property and he was, working with the contractors and that sort of thing. So he didn't go out very much in 85. And of course, in October of 85, he was killed in the accident. And so something evidently worked because I stuck around for a long time. And the first 4 years or so of that, I was, T. Michael Coleman was part of the band. Hmm. So, Michael and I became close during those 4 years and have kept in touch and done a project here and there.
Yeah, and you'll get to play together again at the Doc 100 shows.
Right. It's going to be great fun. We've only done one show, so we're still, kind of figuring out how to approach it. And that's been a work in progress for the last couple of months. So we're getting started up again at the Birchmere in Alexandria, where Doc and Michael as well, we all played for years, 2 or 3 times a year for, 25 years or something. So that's going to be fun. I haven't played at the Birchmere in a couple of years. Michael and I did another Doc tribute show that was supposed to include Wayne Henderson, who canceled at the last minute, but we got our friend Dudley Connell from The Seldom Scene to come in and cover for Wayne. So, you know, that was, and that was a hoot playing with Dudley. We had a good time with that, but I'm looking forward to taking this show back to the Birchmere.
Yeah, it'd be really cool. And so presumably when you started playing with Doc, you were really familiar with a lot of his music prior to that.
You know, in fact, that first show, there was no rehearsal. So he asked me just, you know, 10 minutes before we were going on stage, well, do you know this song? Yeah, I know that one. How about this one? Yeah. And he named three songs, maybe. And he said, well, okay, we'll do those three first and then go from there. And the show went well. And I was familiar with Doc because, you know, from the time I was around 13 or 14. Maybe in the mid 60s, I had some of his records. You know, I had grown up listening and watching Flatt & Scruggs on TV, and my dad was a sound tech at a music hall, so I got to see Flatt & Scruggs live and Bill Monroe live and Porter Wagoner, Dolly Parton, and Jerry Lee Lewis. I mean, everybody came through this music hall where I lived, and so. You know, and my dad made sure to introduce me to all these people as they came through. And, when I was, 13, maybe 14, I discovered Doc, and I'd been trying to play like Earl Scruggs up to that point, fingerstyle. And, you know, I got Doc's first solo record. And was knocked over by it and started working on the flat pick stuff. And, you know, then I discovered Clarence White and I did, you know, through Doc. And then, you know, Glenn Campbell was another huge influence for me. Not to mention, a couple other guitar players in the area here. I mean, Tony, I met Tony Rice we met each other when he was 17 and I was about to turn 15. They moved back to North Carolina. I guess that would have been 1968 or so. And Tony was not as much an influence for me as he just was. He was just another one of the handful of flat pickers in this area. There were a couple of others, and we all competed against each other and at fiddlers conventions and guitar contests and stuff from 68 until, well, really, you know, Tony left in 1970 to do the Bluegrass Alliance thing, and then I left home about a year later and joined the Bluegrass Alliance after he left. So, but it was Doc that got me started on the flat pick thing. And, you know, the On Stage record, when that came out, that was like my Bible for a couple of years. You know, I listened to that over and over and over.
And so, like, back at that first gig, once those three songs are gone and you've kind of, you know, you've gone through the three that you've arranged to play, it's just a case of Doc shouts out a song and then you're off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it never mattered whether I knew the song or not. he would, and that continued until, you know, until the very end. You know, Doc would just turn around to me and say, you know, this is in G. And, you know, I would say, yeah, I know G. And then he would start. And that, like I said, that continued until the almost through the very last gig. You know, and it took a couple of months for me to kind of settle into it. You know, I was I was concentrating more on playing as differently than Doc, more than I was actually playing the song. And it took me, and Doc never said anything one way or the other, you know. You know, he always let me play what I wanted to play when I wanted to play it. He encouraged that. But, you know, I listened to a couple of early shows and realized I was a little outside the pocket. So I reined myself in. And as the years went on, and it didn't take years, but it, you know, within a few months, you know, we learned how to play with each other. You know, it's not always easy when you got two guitars and both play lead, and Doc would never hear doing it any other way. You know, so it's amazing how little time it took for us to lock in together. I mean, especially with Coleman there, who was rock solid. You know, I reined myself in a little bit, and as the years progressed, Doc started getting more adventurous because I kind of played by the seat of my pants. You know, I'm from the Put Your Fingers Anywhere school of music, you know. And you know, luckily it works most of the time. But I noticed Doc getting a little more adventurous in his solos. And after we'd been doing it a number of years, we did a show with Newgrass Revival, and Bela Fleck came to me and gave me what I thought was a real compliment. You know, I mean, he said, "Doc plays better with you than anybody he's ever played with."
I mean, that's,
you know, so I think, you know, I took that as a real compliment. And, you know, like I said, we rubbed off on each other. You know, in fact, as the years went on, you know, our arrangements just happened organically, because Doc would call something we'd never played together, you know, when we're on stage in front of, you know, thousands of people sometimes. And so, you know, after playing the song a few times, if it got into the rotation, after playing it a few times, I'd figure out like a little lick that I did in certain places, a little signature lick that I thought, you know, fit the song. And on occasion, we'd be playing the song and I'd realize, you know, Doc's playing my part. And so I have to figure out something else to do, which was, you know, again, you know, I take that as a real compliment. You know, Doc was always very gracious with anybody who played with him, you know, to let them have their moment in the sun. You know, we'd have people come up and sit in with us over the course of the years, you know, Sam Bush, David Greer, you know, just Jerry Douglas, Mike Aldridge. I mean, it just, everybody wanted to play with Doc for one thing. And we loved that. And so we'd have people sit in all the time, you know, and after I'd been there just a couple of months, he asked me to start singing a few songs on the shows as well. So, you know, I remember going into the recording studio and we had to tell Doc, "Hey, you're giving all the, you know, you need to take your solos. You're giving them all away. I mean, this is a Doc Watson record, you know, you're giving all the solos away. You know, you need to play your solos." So he, you know, but he just loved, especially the younger, you know, people of my generation, which now we're the elders, kind of, but back when I started with him, which is approaching 40 years ago, you know, he always hung out with younger musicians, you know, for the most part. And I think that's what kept him vital, you know, well into his 70s. And well, and to his 80s.
And that sort of point you were talking about, you know, giving away his solos and being sort of very generous as a musician. And just, I was watching the other day one of the Homespun doc videos, which is the one that was filmed at Merlefest. And, you know, another artist, you would buy their video and it's them showing you their stuff. But there's bits just going, right, let's go and look at what Jack's doing. Let's go and, you know, deconstruct that break that Jack just played. And it's, you know, it's just a sort of generosity of we're all making this music together. And so it's all interesting, which just is right. Not always the case.
Yeah. I didn't know I was even going to be part of that thing until late the night before. And, you know, it was at like 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning. At a festival where, you know, of course, I, you know, up late the night before, and so I looked pretty ragged, but we played well.
Yeah, and it's a great video, and it's, you know, it's things like that. They give you real insight into, I think, the fact that we've got all these videos of players over the decades that Happy and Homespun and other companies have put out is just a wonderful document of some of those things, particularly when it's not in a studio, when it is at a festival setting and there's, you know, a lot of chat as well.
Right. Yeah. There are a number of videos out there, starting with VHS, which nobody uses anymore, that I was a part of, you know, with Doc. And one in particular was a set from Merlefest. I think it was 92. I'm not sure, but it was Doc, Tony Rice, Dan Crary, and Steve Kaufman. And it's just a guitar set, you know, and you know, and that was also done at Merlefest, I think the year after the Homespun thing, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, it's great to have all that documented. And just sort of thinking about you touring with Doc, because obviously, you know, you're talking about Doc never told you what to play, and he very much let you play in your own style, and you were very conscious of that. Because so touring with Doc, there's two sides to that. One is to play in the places that Merle had played with him. And Merle had his own very distinctive style as well. He wasn't just sitting there back in Doc up. But also just the amount of time you would be spending with Doc on the road as well. It's, you know, it's there's a musical relationship and a personal relationship there.
Oh, of course. You know, I spent more time on the road with Doc than I did with my growing family for years. And, you know, sometimes it was hard when Coleman was still with us that first 4 years, we could kind of split the responsibilities. You know, I mean, we would fly and rent cars and, you know, to get to the gigs. And so, you know, one of us would get Doc through security at the airport and while the other, or pick up the bags while the other guy goes to get the rental car and that sort of thing. And after Coleman left the band in, I believe it was October of 87, it was just Doc and me on the road. So, that it was hard work, you know. I mean, the 2 hours that we spent playing the show was the best part of the day. You know, and you know, also after Coleman left, I mean, I had to do all the driving, because Doc drives too fast, and you know, but that's always our joke. And you know, and as time progressed, you know, Doc brought me in as a full partner. And even before that happened, I was also booking the flights, booking the rental cars in the hotels, and you know, doing all the road manager stuff too. So eventually Doc brought me in as a full partner, and you know, compensated me for a lot of that extra work.
And it's, you know, any kind of touring situation where it's just a couple of you, it's a lot of time to spend with another person, and particularly over a span of, you know, quarter of a century, it's, you know, and the touring in those situations 20 years older than you were when you started doing it, you know, that kind of work affects you in different ways at different stages in your life. And, you know, it's a remarkable relationship.
Yeah, you know, there were very few times we had a crossword over that span. But there, you know, just like a marriage, you know, there are going to be times when you butt heads and, you know, say stuff that you might not really mean, or some stuff that you really do mean. So, you know, it was a lot, but that happened very, very seldom. You know, we were pretty tight friends. And, you know, and that's, I think, you know, Merle's trust in me really, really kind of, well, I don't know. You know, Merle's trust in me rubbed off on Doc. I mean, Doc trusted me because he's, you know, Merle did, and he trusted Merle.
Yeah.
You know, it just prior to Merle's death, maybe 5 weeks or so, they were recording Doc's only bluegrass record, Riding the Midnight Train, the only bluegrass record he ever really did. And he called me one day and said, while we were recording it, and asked me to fly to Nashville and meet Doc and T. Michael and drive to a couple of gigs that were there after the recording session. And Merle called me that night. I just moved right into his hotel room after I got there. And about 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that, you know, the phone rings, and it's Merle. And we talked for about an hour or so. And, you know, he never really gave me any reasons, but, you know, he told me during that conversation that he was going to step back from touring. And, you know, he was just kind of tired of the road and, you know, wanted to do something else. I mean, he was his happiest when he was, you know, organizing a construction crew or riding his tractor or clearing land. I mean, that's what he loved doing that. But anyway, he said, I'm not going to be doing this very much longer. And I just want to know, you know, you and Dad get along well and you play well together. I'm going to be stepping back, and you know, I just want to make sure that you're in, and you know, you'll take care of Dad, and and everything. And I said, well, of course I will. I mean, I've been doing it for, almost 2 years at that point. And I said, of course I will. And that was the last time I ever spoke with Merle. I got a call about, maybe a month later from T. Michael, telling me what had happened. And Merle was, had a real sense of humor about his place in the group those last couple of years. I'd been out there, especially the last year, 85, 85, 84 through 85, really. I'd been out there most of the time. And so on the shows that Merle decided he was going to play, people would come up and tell him they were kind of surprised to see him because he hadn't been out for a while. And he'd just tell them, well, I'm filling in for Jack. So, Merle, when he died, I think was maybe the happiest I'd seen him in a while. And, I think maybe being off the road was good for him.
Mm. Yeah, it doesn't suit everybody. And it's, as you say, there's a lot of responsibilities go with it. And
yeah, well, he'd been on the road at the point of his death. He'd been on the road with his father for 20 years, basically. And, that's, believe me, that's a long time. That's a long time to stay with one act, because up until I was with a dozen acts before I started playing with Doc. And, that just, the whole Doc thing just really clicked. I think the best either one of us ever played was when we played together.
It's an interesting span of time to spend, like, in one musical situation, in just in terms of the arc of that as well. I'd be really interested to know if over the course of that 25 years, so like how Doc was perceived, because we look back on Doc now as this figure on the sort of Mount Rushmore of American acoustic music. And there's, post Will the Circle Be Unbroken, Doc was put in a whole new light by that. But there must have been a journey between those points where sometimes he was much more in the spotlight, and the acoustic music in general comes and goes in popularity, particularly through the 80s and 90s. It's
right. Well, the circle record saved Doc's career. I mean, in 1971, between the Circle record and the influx and the popularity of bluegrass festivals, which, in the early 70s was really starting to take off here, but the Circle record was that saved Doc and Merle's career, because they were kind of struggling a little before that. So that was a big shot in the arm for them. And then couple that, like I said, with the bluegrass festivals becoming hot. And, when I first started playing with Doc, we were playing dinky little clubs, what would happen, we'd get an anchor gig, a nice theater gig or something, then book clubs and stuff around that gig. And we did that for several years. And then around 1990, Doc decided he was going to retire. And so we didn't do anything for we played out the gigs we had, and then we didn't do anything for about 2 months or 3 months. I'd gotten involved with a I'd gotten involved with a guitar shop and doing some guitar repair and staying at home for the first time in years. And that lasted for about 3 months. And Doc called me and said, well, do you, you know, I really want to go out and play some more, you know, play again. And I just said, I just told him, said, you know, look, I feel good being home for the first time in years. I've gotten involved with this guitar shop thing that's just getting off the ground. You know, I'm not sure I want to, go out, you know. And so he said, well, I understand. And we hung up. And about half an hour, 40 minutes later, he called me again. And said, you know, I can't do this without you. You know, I really feel like I need to go out. Here's what, here's my proposition. I'm going to take fewer, I'm going to double the price or double the fee that we're normally getting. And only go out maybe 2 weekends a month, just a couple of days at a time. And so eventually, you know, those fees did get doubled and tripled in some cases. He said, we'll just take the expenses off the top and split whatever's left. And, you know, I mean, that gave, and I, that was an offer I couldn't turn down. I mean, that was, you know, it was very generous for one thing, but, you know, I would have been crazy to turn that offer down. And given the relaxed schedule, you know, I still could put in the time at the guitar shop, which, you know, I did that for about 5 years as, you know, and played with Doc at the same time until I got out of the guitar shop business.
And did you, was there a point, you know, around 2000 when Oh Brother just gave all forms of acoustic sort of bluegrass related music a shot in the arm? Was there a sudden sort of resurgence and interest for Doc's music after that? Because it just is so easy for somebody like me who's got into bluegrass since then just to see all these things as always having been in the spotlight. But I know that things changed.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much Oh Brother. I know it was a big boost for bluegrass and string band music, really, because, you know, quite honestly, there was not a whole lot of bluegrass in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, real bluegrass music. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, but, you know, it gave acoustic music in general a big shot in the arm, just like Bonnie and Clyde did in the 60s and Deliverance did in the 70s. You know, all of those movies gave a little bit of boost to it, you know, to the music. You know, acoustic and roots music, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Doc never considered himself bluegrass, and he did not really like it much when people pigeonholed him as a bluegrass guy. He told me, he said, I've never been in a bluegrass band. I've only done one bluegrass record. You know, I'm not a bluegrass artist, you know, but he didn't take into consideration the impact his guitar playing had for guitar players in bluegrass bands. And, you know, plus, you know, the lines have been blurred about what is and isn't bluegrass for years.
Yeah.
But Doc was always, you know, adamant that, you know, I can play bluegrass and I play, there's some of the stuff that I do that's, you know, flavored like that and certainly has those influences, but I'm not a bluegrass artist. And he finally came up with a term that just about everybody could understand, and basically just would tell people, say, well, I play traditional plus. And they'd ask, well, what's that? He said, well, it's traditional music plus whatever the hell I want to play.
Yeah, and that's it's very true that Doc gets a lot. You have conversations about bluegrass guitarists, and Doc comes up as one of the, you know, the biggest influences on people. But you know, bluegrass is a specific format of a band with certain instruments and certain stylistic things, and so many things that get lumped in around that don't really fit that mold.
Right. Yeah, and that's how Doc felt about it. You know, so we don't have a mandolin and a banjo and a fiddle. You know, we can't play bluegrass. You know, I mean, he had his idea of what bluegrass is, and he wasn't it.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I think it's, you know, and there's something good about that. I think that whole idea of traditional plus and not fitting into predefined versions of what music has to be, just playing music that you like in the way that you like it. And that's Doc Watson, you know. Doc Watson was sort of a genre to himself in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people at first, you know, Doc was a big fan of the Moody Blues. We did Nights in White Satin. Mm. And, you know, just recently I read a review. You know, Doc and I never recorded it together. We played it all the time. He would go on and on about, you know, the Moody Blues and how he loved that song. And he had worn out an 8-track tape of that song, of that album. And so finally it came out on compact disc, and I bought it for him as a Christmas present or something. And the next time we went out on tour, he pulled out Nights in White Satin. And just recently, I don't know if it was a review in Bluegrass Unlimited, I think, that mentioned, maybe it's on a compilation or a video or something, Doc's version of that. Well, it wasn't a video. I think it was the record he did with the Frosty Morn guys at Merlefest. They recorded it then. And somebody, and recently there was a review of that song, and they wondered who talked Doc into playing that. They didn't like it at all. And, you know, I came very close to writing a letter to the editor and saying, nobody twisted his arm to play that song. He loved that song. Yeah, you know, I mean, you didn't tell Doc what to do very often. I mean, especially musically, you never told him what to do. And he afforded me the same thing. He never told me what to play or when to play. So, you know, just go with it.
Oh, that's really cool. You know, there's just the idea that anybody would twist Doc's arm. Anybody who is that certain about their own musical style and that comfortable with who they are and that sure of their own musical intent, the idea that you could convince them to do anything they didn't want to do, seems almost laughable.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never, you know, I mean, I had a little bit of a problem when I was young with band leaders that wanted me to play like a certain, well, for one, Lonnie Pierce with the Bluegrass Alliance, you know, they'd already had Dan Crary and they'd had Tony, and you know, I was the next up, and Lonnie wanted to go back to the pre-Tony sound, you know, and he wanted me to play like Dan Crary, and I just said, you know, I can't. You know, I can't. Nobody can play just like somebody else, you know. I can't do that. He said, well, I want you to learn band solos. And I said, Lonnie, if you had told me that before you hired me, you know, when you offered me the job, I would have turned it down. You know, I would have turned it down. And so, you know, we kind of butted heads over that. And I was only 18 years old at the time. And even then, you know, I was, you know, was I influenced by Dan? Of course I was. You know, his bluegrass guitar record was terrific. You know, I would say that I was more influenced by Dan than Tony. Oh, for sure, much more. But I didn't want to be Dan. and you know, when so I went through a succession of bands, you know, before I got the thing with Doc, and it was just so refreshing at that, you know, at that point. And hey, here's a guy that's going to let me be me and decide, you know, let me decide what I want to play when I want to play it.
And that's Jack Lawrence. That was such a cool conversation to get to have. I mean, I enjoyed that immensely. So we've heard from some people who worked with Doc. We've heard from some people who played and toured with Doc. We're going to finish this first episode with a couple of people who didn't work with Doc, but have had and are having a big role on taking Doc's legacy forward into the next 100 years. And first up, we're going to hear from Lindsay Craven, who is Artist Relations Manager at Merlefest. And she's going to just chat about how Doc's vision and Doc's sense of traditional plus music is being carried on through the work Merlefest are doing now. So here's Lindsay Craven of Merlefest.
So I actually started with Merlefest as a college intern my junior year of college at Appalachian State University. I actually came on initially through the advertising and marketing department, I believe. I was working with Art Minius and spent the spring semester doing that with him, and ended up during the festival, somehow or other, I ended up in the artist relations department during the festival, which deals with getting the artists where they need to be, taking care of them while they're on site, dealing with hotels and all the stuff that involves artists during the weekend. And then the following spring, my senior year, they actually reached back out to me and asked if I'd like to come back with the artist relations team. And so, you know, why would I not? That's an awesome opportunity as a college student. So I returned and worked with John Adair his first year as the artist relations manager, and learned a lot that year, had a much different experience. They had moved things around. So you were actually, the first year of the festival, I was actually working like from a good distance away from the festival grounds. So it was kind of a different experience. But the next year they had a production trailer backstage. And so we were kind of in the heart of everything that was happening at the main stage. So it was a lot different. But from then on, they just kept inviting me back to either work the festival weekend as a volunteer, or I worked as a part-time employee sometimes when they needed some help during the year, because I was always, you know, half hour to an hour away from the campus. So I had various degrees across multiple artist relations managers. And then when Steve Johnson decided he was going to take a different path in 2018, he encouraged me to apply. So I did. And thankfully, they felt I would do a good job in the role.
And it's an exciting year to be doing that job, because there's so much going on, like, you know, all over the place, celebrating Doc's 100th birthday. And presumably you've got some special things lined up for the festival this year.
We do. We have a Doc's 100th birthday jam that's going to happen on Saturday on the main stage. It's hosted by the Kruger Brothers, and there will have lots of special guests there. We're still working on putting that lineup together, and I'm sure I'm even going to be surprised on who pops up on stage, as I usually am with these jams. But they're always pleasant surprises. So I can't wait to see how that comes together. The Krugers, you know, they have an intense love and respect for Doc. So we know that they're going to do that jam justice, and we're excited to see it come together.
And it's sort of been cool to see that respect and that excitement from all over the place as we sort of approach, you know, Doc's 100th birthday. It will be Doc's 100th birthday when this comes out. From that point on through to Merlefest and probably beyond, it feels like a sort of a long celebration of Doc, and not just Doc's music, but the way people talk about Doc as a human and as an inspiration, just an all round you know, inspirational figure beyond just the music is so, it's lovely to see.
Yes. Every time I turn on social media, I feel like I see a new tribute show or album or something honoring Doc this year. And that's, it's very exciting to see. It's great, you know, for us to get to see Doc get the attention and honor that he deserves. Not that he doesn't get that any other year, but this year especially. And, you know, Doc was, I think Doc's a lot like Dolly in the culture of just, he was just a good person with a good mentality towards music and towards open-mindedness. And I think people see that, and it's just refreshing these days to see. So he's kind of an icon that will live on.
Yeah, that's a really interesting comparison, because they are sort of both figures that, you know, very different in many, many ways, but at the same time, sort of bridge gaps and pull people together from all over the place, and, you know, with a sort of effortless, seemingly effortless, just, you know, strength of character and charm.
Exactly. And I think, you know, their music just speaks across genres and, you know, introduced a lot of people to different genres of music that they never would have listened to otherwise, but inspired generations.
And that's one of the cool things about Mellfest's sort of ongoing commitment to Doc's traditional plus sort of mindset of, you know, you look at the lineup and it's not a bluegrass festival, right. Although there's plenty of bluegrass there, but it's, that must be a really cool sort of ongoing challenge to add to that and build to that. And, you know, presumably when Doc was around, he had a bit of a say in what was going on, but to take that and then just keep growing, it must be a cool challenge to have.
Yeah, we always, I mean, Doc's always in mind when we build these lineups. You know, we kind of put together a programming formula that was guided by him initially. And, you know, the traditional plus is always in our minds of, yes, we love bluegrass. And yes, a lot of people think we're a bluegrass festival, but we do so much more. And, you know, we always try to make sure we have a very good balance throughout the entire weekend and even each day of different types of music for everybody to enjoy.
It's, I think doing these interviews for the podcast, the thing that most people have, I think the most common theme is how much people love the breadth of repertoire Doc had. That, you know, you say the word bluegrass, he wasn't even really a bluegrass musician. but in just the range of stuff he was able to pull in and turn into his own is what inspired people as much as any individual instrumental skill or piece of music.
Yes. And we have, you know, jams that are not new to this year, but will continue this year. We have like a Dockabilly jam that Mitch Greenhill hosts. So, you know, that's got a whole different side of Doc. We have the gospel songs of Doc Watson on Sunday on our Creekside stage, that Jeff Little hosts. And Jack Lawrence does a songs of Doc Watson, on one of our traditional stages. So there's all different styles of Doc across the festival, and the people who played with him and knew him the best are honoring that memory and that music.
And presumably there's a lot of people who come to Mellfest every year and have been coming for a long time, and this year will be a really meaningful year for them.
Yes, I'm sure we have some audience members who've been with us for all 35 years this year. And we are so grateful for those people who've stuck it out with us for this long, and especially through the difficulties of COVID. So, and then we've got some that have been bringing their families since their children were little, and now they're bringing grandchildren. So it's pretty cool to look out in our audience and see the diversity that's out there. We definitely have a wide range of audience members. And then we've got some, you know, we've got the college, Appalachian State, just 30 minutes up the road. So, you know, when we have certain performers like the Avett Brothers, and I think Maren Morris will probably reflect that as well, that just draws them down, and that's usually their first experience at Mellfest. And they hopefully fall in love with it, and they start coming every year as well.
And hopefully this sort of spotlight on Doc for the next few months, particularly with, you know, people who have the size of audience of Billy Strings and the amount of Doc chat that's going to be around for 2 or 3 months now, we'll bring some new people in and a new generation, and that will keep it all going.
I 100% think so. I mean, Billy, though we haven't been able to get him back on the lineup since 2020, we hope to at some point. But I think he's doing amazing things for introducing people to new genres and to musicians that they need to know. You know, people need to know who Doc is. And I think Billy is really doing a service there in honoring all of these artists that inspired him and that have taught him.
I think that's one of the coolest things. He's, you know, he's not just doing the material. He's telling people where it came from. And it, then that just carries on that tradition and it keeps things moving, which is whether you talk about bluegrass or folk or any sort of traditional music, that's how it keeps going. It's new people pick it up and take it somewhere a bit further down the line and hand it on to somebody else.
Absolutely. And I think he's 100% doing that. Tip my hat to him for sure for that. There's not a lot of that out there, but he's definitely one of them carrying the torch. And I think he's inspiring others to do the same.
I think that's it. So each generation has a figure who people just relate to and see what they're doing and love it. And Doc very much seems to have been that for that generation that he sort of grew up inspiring and people who came to that music in the 60s and the 70s. And it's, you know, there'll always be somebody. And it was definitely Doc at his time.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, I think Doc has inspired probably millions, honestly, you know, across the globe. I mean, he traveled outside of the U.S. plenty of times. So I know that there's people who can look back and say, Doc definitely inspired me in my music or in my life across the world.
Cool. That was Lindsay Craven, Artist Relations Manager at Melfest. Just really interesting getting an insight into how they're carrying Doc's work and Doc's vision and Doc's inspiration on. It's not just preserving a thing, sticking it in a glass case, and it's keeping it alive and keeping it living and keeping it breathing. And my final guest in this episode is going to talk a bit about that as well. This is Ted Olson, and Ted's a professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University. He also co-produced the Doc at 100 shows that are going on at the moment and will continue to go on. But he also wrote the liner notes, which makes them sound like something less than they are, but he wrote the book, basically, that accompanies the Doc box set that came out last year, A Life's Work. To take us out, we're going to hear from Ted Olson about writing the liner notes for that box set. Here comes Ted.
Living in Western North Carolina for many years, Doc was often thought of, I think nationally, perhaps beyond, as primarily a North Carolina artist from the Western North Carolina mountains in Watauga County, North Carolina. But as I learned living in Johnson City, Tennessee, he in fact got much of his musical launch from participating in a band based in Johnson City, Tennessee, which is, you know, I want to estimate 60 miles or so from where he lived. And so I started to piece together in my own mind as an educator and as a teacher of American roots music and all the many subgenres of American music that we taught here, I started to piece together a narrative of Doc because, frankly, there wasn't that much written about him during those years. I mean, he was ubiquitous around the area in concerts and traveling through, and everybody loved him and everybody kind of had met him and heard him in concert. But the whole story of Doc hadn't really been committed to paper. And perhaps there were a lot of myths about Doc that you know, perpetuated in you know, at festivals and when people talked about Doc. I started to piece together a story in my mind. And it came to be that I realized I met people who knew Doc back in the 50s when he played on the street in Johnson City and when he played in a band led by the great piano player Jack Williams. It was Jack Williams, based in Johnson City, led this band, had learned about Doc, invited Doc to participate in his band, which was, for want of a better way to describe them, they were kind of a country rockabilly band. But they played popular music, they played dance music, some old-time music, but primarily country and perhaps popular rockabilly crossover music, and some show tunes and things like that. So it was a versatile band, and Doc was steeped in a diversity of American popular music at that time. And I realized that he was all around us in Johnson City, and so when I was given the invitation in 2018 to write the liner notes, and in fact, to compile the box set dedicated to the complete life works of Doc Watson, I finally had an opportunity to place on paper the pieces of the puzzle of Doc that I had been piecing together in my own mind over these years. And mind you, Doc was somebody I looked up to when I was in under 10 years old and first saw him at a performance and just was awed and amazed by his talent and his good humor and his humanity and his interconnectedness with everybody around him, his band, his audience. He had a magical gift at communicating. That really moved me as a kid. It continued to move me as an adult. So I accepted this role to compile the tracks for the box set, which was to be put out by Kraft Recordings, which is affiliated with Concord Music. And I was also given the opportunity to write liner notes. And I'd done a lot of writing of liner notes. So that was actually something I relished, this opportunity to take this role and to tell Doc's story. Happily for all concerned, I hope, but certainly happily for me, it was an open-ended invitation. I was not given a page limit. I was basically said, write the story and we'll use it. And so it ended up being, frankly, almost book length. Maybe not, an academic book length, but it was a hefty tome that came out of this exercise. And all it was for me was piecing together and creating a filled in puzzle of who was Doc and why he was so meaningful to me, but also much more importantly to everybody. So I feel as if undertaking of writing liner notes to in conjunction with the box set dedicated to Doc's documenting Doc's complete career was, I believe, in some respects, one of the first opportunities that anyone had had to tell this story. And I told it from my perspective, of course, but frankly, it's not really a personal essay at all because I had never met him. What I mean to say is I delved into the stories and that I had about Doc and the questions I had about his talent and his gift. And I explored those in my prose, but I also, pretty quickly realized that I can't tell the story of Doc Watson from my limited experience. It's going to be limited. I want to tell a fuller story. And so I began a process of interviewing people. I ended up interviewing many people who knew Doc extremely well for decades and gracious souls who answered questions and spoke with me on the phone on multiple occasions. And their quotes and their insights with their blessing went into the liner notes as well. So I think it's a multivocal interpretation of Doc's career and his life and his importance to all of us. And in essence, I remain in Johnson City, Tennessee, realizing that this great artist was very much a part of my community here, as much as he was, of course, in North Carolina, but anywhere. I feel as if he was, in some ways, a citizen of the lives of people all over the world, as I came to learn. And he was a valued citizen of musical communities everywhere.
And that's really interesting. It's that exactly what you described there, being sort of the confluence of a personal attachment to Doc's music. And that's also sense that it was a shared thing. Everybody has their own very personal attachment to what Doc did, but at the same time, it is such a shared joy as well. And that's one of the things I found just, putting this episode together, is the amount of people who've been generous enough to talk to me and share thoughts and memories and connections. And it's a beautiful thing. It's interesting. You were talking about Doc as being seen as very much a musician of one particular area. And although I think you're absolutely right, his music's gone everywhere, he is still very grounded in that area, in a lot of people's perspectives. And I wondered, you were talking about sort of Appalachian culture and sharing that with people. And I wondered sort of how you feel Doc fits into that, because he is so known for a geographic area as well as just being a global musician.
Well, that was the great balancing act of Doc Watson. He remained in one place. He remained where he was born throughout his life. He was a good neighbor to everybody. He didn't know a stranger. He devoted his Saturday mornings to going to the local music store when he was rich, and, well, not rich, but when he was famous. I don't think the former was really an issue for him, but he was rich in spirit for sure, and rich in achievement. And he shared that connection to a music legacy that he embodied with younger generations at that music store. I mean, he was such a giver of his gift to other people. Children loved to talk with Doc there at that music store, and he could have been many other places, but that's where he chose to be. So that's how grounded he was. He was enriching the lives of others in his home community after he would get home from trips across the country and abroad, enriching lives of people elsewhere. So I think he felt at home in the world, but he certainly was grounded in Appalachia and in his part of Appalachia bordering North Carolina and Tennessee, the mountainous region there and the Blue Ridge area there. And I would say that he sometimes referred to Appalachia as his home base, but I feel as if he was maybe not an overt diplomat, but he was, diplomacy was part of what he did. I mean, he promoted positive understanding of Appalachia everywhere he went without having to beat the drum about it. He was a very humble person and very aware of our common humanity. And I never felt as if he understood what stereotypes were, and I think he actively defied them in everything he did, but he never did so angrily. I think he did so just by the graceful example of a well-lived life and a tolerance of, you know, the challenges that he faced. I mean, he was a very brave man to be touring the United States on the bus alone before he traveled with Merle and others later in his career. So like I said, I think he just was a person who was at home in the world wherever he went, but he never forgot who he was, and who he was of course being of the place from which he was born and the culture that fostered him and enriched his life with music that he shared with others. So again, it's that great, achievement of that great balancing act of being many things in one lifetime.
And that was Ted Olson, my final guest for this episode. There's a second episode, and in that I'm going to talk to a lot more people who've seen Doc over the years, been influenced by Doc. You know, some have worked with Doc, some didn't know Doc. There's a real range of people. I mean, I'm going to talk to Mike Marshall, Tim O'Brien. I'm going to talk to Brian Sutton. I'm going to talk to Chris Eldridge. I'm going to talk to Laurie Lewis. There's such a range of fascinating stuff in this part two. So please, please do download part two as well. I will see you over there. I hope you've enjoyed this. But I'll see you in part two. Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.